Once a month, we visit with our partners at the Southern Oregon University Laboratory of Anthropology, SULA, for a segment we call Underground History. Chelsea Rose of SULA brings in people and stories about archaeology and the intricate and fascinating process of truly unearthing the past. This month, we have to acknowledge the current context of the fires that swept through the region. What were homes and places of business have become overnight, in essence, archaeological sites. And then, of course, there's the additional issue of historic buildings and structures and collections lost to fires. We have three guests with us. Well, Chelsea Rose and two guests. Chelsea, welcome back.
Thanks. Good to be here.
Good to have you. George Kramer is a historical preservation consultant in the Rogue Valley. George, good to hear from you again.
Hello, Jeff.
And Curry Gill is with us as well from Oregon Heritage, which is the State Historic Preservation Office. Welcome, Curry.
Thank you.
So let's start things off. I mean, how widespread do the impacts appear on historic structures? Let's start with that aspect of it. Curry, why don't you take that up?
Well, we're still getting assessment, I will say, to start off. The fires were all over the state. Many of the public lands like Forest Service and BLM lands that have historic properties, we don't have full assessments yet. And in the smaller communities, in some cases, people haven't gone back. We do know that there has been loss. Happily, there have been some reports of things not lost. So it's not totally clear yet what the numbers look like.
George Kramer, what do you know about the region of the Rogue Valley that you're most familiar with and what the impacts have been on historic structures?
Well, of course, downtown Talent and downtown Phoenix were hard hit. There was at least one National Register building in downtown Talent, Hanscom Hall, built in 1906. It was completely lost. A number of other buildings that were probably what we call eligible resources that were historically significant in those communities but had not been listed on the National Register for whatever reason. And they've all been lost, or many of them have been lost along the main streets in those towns. And I also know, Jeff, on Curry's comment, I have clients in the northern part of the state that have properties on forest land along the Clackamas River.
There was one little workers' village built in the 20s, had 15 resources, 8 of them are gone.
Wow. Okay. That's a bunch. Definitely some damage out there, and not just in Southern Oregon, as we pointed out. And it's interesting to watch as you get a chance to pull back from the immediacy of crisis in the Rogue Valley to notice how much other damage there was around the state of Oregon. So quite a bit of that. Curry, what appear to be the hardest hit areas from your quick overview?
So up the, of course, Talon and Phoenix, like mm-hmm. George mentioned, but up the McKenzie River, mm-hmm. Blue River area and Vida were hard hit, and then up the Santa Yam, so Detroit, Mill City, those were pretty drastically impacted as well.
And I know from reading the media reports that there's not much left of either Blue River or Detroit. Does that square with what you're hearing as well?
Yes, there are a few structures, but there's a lot missing there. And again, those are areas too where certainly the Blue River area, they're doing some reporting, but with the rainfall in addition to the fires, the safety levels, they're still pretty risky. So not a lot of people have been able to access that.
All right. It seems unusual in our time in history to get to a point where we're talking about entire communities pretty much being destroyed by fire, but that appears to have happened in these places. I mean, is it as unusual as I think at this point in history?
From my perspective, yes. Yeah. I mean, these properties and the ones that George mentioned have been here, some of them over 100 years, and they haven't faced this yet. Mm-hmm. In the last 40 years, maybe the ones that are out in the forests, mm-hmm. in the woods, have been at higher risk, and we've lost them. But whole communities like this is
interesting too, Jeffrey. I did some research on the history of Bandon, which burned in the 1917 and again in the 30s.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember reading the stories about the fire department and all the challenges they had to get water to the fires and all the mishaps and stuff, and it seemed like, oh my gosh, we're so much better off now and we have all this figured out. But then now some of the stories coming out about the challenges that even in today's day and age with all the modern technology, they just still couldn't get water in a lot of places because the reservoirs drained or they didn't have the pressure. So it's been really interesting to see some of these same issues and that happened historically fighting fires still are issues today.
Yeah, things that we don't think would be issues in today's world, but they were. And I'm still trying to piece together in my own mind and through research why, but water pressure was lost in Talent. You probably saw the same story. It's on the front page of the Mail Tribune today. It was in the tidings, I guess, yesterday, about the fact that the crews that lined up on Talent Avenue to try to keep the fire from crossing that to the west found dry hydrants.
Yeah. Yeah, so, I mean, even these communities in modern times still have a lot of the same challenges that have historically plagued Oregon communities with fire, which was an interesting thing that I didn't expect.
Right. We're talking about the fire damage and restoration and archaeology and all those things tied together in this month's Underground History with Chelsea Rose from SULA, the Southern Oregon University Laboratory of Anthropology. We also have with us Curry Gill from Oregon Heritage, which is the State Historic Preservation Office, and George Kramer, a historical preservation consultant based in the Rogue Valley, but as he's pointed out, working all across Oregon. And you can join the conversation on the exchange. Talk about historic structures lost, saved, and where we go from here. 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. George, I imagine you've worked on a few buildings over the years that at least had been touched by fire. I mean, is there a normal protocol for where things go at this point?
Well, certainly I have been involved in buildings that had fire, and it creates some challenges and sometimes, frankly, some opportunities towards reconstruction. You go in and you evaluate the structural condition of what's left, and then you make a decision about whether it's economically viable to rebuild. And sometimes that happens and sometimes it doesn't. It struck me, Jeff, when Chelsea was talking about the pattern of history, a lot of the cities in the Rogue Valley in the 19th century that were wood frame, Medford, Ashlands, and Grants Pass, suffered severe fires, and the response to that was to require fireproof construction going forward. Grants Pass, in particular, their reconstruction in the 1880s was delayed because there wasn't enough brick available for all the reconstruction. But Talent and Phoenix, because they're smaller communities, never really had that same kind of effect, although they did have fires. The Hanscom Hall building, the National Register building that was lost in Talent, was used temporarily as the city hall after a fire in 1910. Hmm. So history just kind of has a way of repeating itself, and all of the issues, lack of water and, of course, not enough people to fight as many fires all at the same time as were all factors then, too.
And Curry Gill, I was reading through the five-page wildfire response and recovery put out by Oregon Heritage, and it's rather comprehensive, but there's a bunch of steps here recommended, largely assessing what your community needs above all else first.
Absolutely. For the historic sites that are lost, there's some conversation for the community to have about that and the impact of that and how they choose to respond to it. And then for those that remain, they may be one of fewer now and may be more significant. And so what can they do to help the community in its community recovery? These historical societies in Talent and Phoenix that remain, they have the records of what these communities look like and its history, and they can certainly participate in the recovery in those communities by giving an anchor, by recognizing how the communities have identified themselves over the past years, and ensure that as they rebuild and recover, that is recognized and used as a way to process all of this.
Chelsea, and what you've been reading about Bandon and its two major fires, what role could you discern, if any, about the effect of historical societies or historians on putting the town back together?
Well, in Bandon, they took it as an opportunity to kind of shift things over a little bit. So the town that was rebuilt looked quite a bit different than the original town. But I think one of the things to keep in mind, too, with the role of heritage is that communities are more than just the buildings that they're made up by. There's a lot of kind of intangible heritage and things that are more non-traditional, you know, not just old buildings, but ethnic neighborhoods and different kind of cultural aspects of communities that also can be impacted by these sorts of catastrophic events, and that the heritage aspects can help bring them back together. And, you know, like, for example, you live in Talent, and there's so much different about your community now, and a lot of that is not necessarily what we'd immediately think of heritage, but heritage can play a role in rebuilding that.
Well, when you mention neighborhoods, too, it brings to mind the fact that so much of what was lost was affordable housing stock, and mobile home parks took it really, really hard. George Kramer, I just wonder how hard a historical consultant works to try to convince people that, hey, you know, you might want to consider things going back to something like what they were, at least in affordability, or if that's something for other people to discuss.
Well, I think that that's the single biggest role we can play here. I've been talking to people in Talent already about going forward and making sure, you know, a lot of times when you rebuild, when towns rebuild, it's sort of perceived as an opportunity to change things in a significant way. But I think that heritage and culture, as Chelsea says, these are all folks that are part of these communities, and we need to make sure that whatever gets built back accommodates that part of the demographic. You know, a lot of the mobile home parks were people that don't have a lot of capacity. Some of them didn't have insurance, and the community is coming together to help them right now. But I would hope that whatever we build in that place not only reflects the heritage and the character of the town, but the people that inhabited the community before the fire, too.
And Curry Gill, I wonder what kind of thoughts you have at Oregon Heritage about that. But to take some care, or at least to register the concern that fires don't become something like an urban renewal project in the 1960s sense of the term.
Absolutely. And to ensure that when the rebuilding does happen for those neighborhoods, especially ones like Chelsea mentioned, that have cultural significance, a community significance, that's recognized and not discarded and not replaced, or at least that they're involved in that decision making. So community engagement through all of this, I think, is the critical key, and ensuring that all the people, like George mentioned, in town get to participate in this process.
I noticed in your document about 2020 wildfire response and recovery, there's a lot there about making sure that there's a place at the table that just makes sure that the voice of the heritage community is heard, in addition to all the others that need to be heard in the process.
Absolutely. That's critical, and I think it's easy to lose track of that when people are thinking of the immediate, which is shelter, right? People need a place to land and be, and the sooner they can feel stable, the better. But when there's so much damage in an entire community, I think as many players and people and community members who can participate in that recovery and redevelopment, the stronger the community is going to be at the end of that.
Mm-hmm. Everybody will feel an ownership stake in it, like, hey, this is my community. I helped rebuild it. We are talking on Underground History about fire impacts around the region, which have been great on both sides of the state line. Chelsea Rose from the Southern Oregon University Laboratory of Anthropology with us once again. And we also have with us Curry Gill from the from Oregon Heritage and Underground History's, well, he's a historical preservationist. George Kramer is with us as well. And you can join this conversation at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.com. Chelsea, I want to talk at least a little bit about archaeological techniques, because they can prove handy, I would think, for people who are trying to find treasured artifacts in what was a home and that is now a pile of ashes. And I noticed that a group that we're talking to next week, Samaritan's Purse, is coming to help people sift through some of the rubble. What kinds of things can you impart to people to give them a hand?
Yeah, so, you know, I've done a lot of work on archaeological houses that have burned as well, and they're pretty similar. So you can identify activity areas, and then within that you can kind of narrow down where things are most likely to be in that area. So I've had some friends that have been thankfully able to recover family heirlooms already from the fires, and they were able to do that by pinpointing, okay, here's the bedroom, here's the closet, here's where this is most likely to be. So that can definitely be effective. One of the things that's challenging with modern fires like this compared to archaeological ones that I usually work on is there's so many more hazardous materials that people really need to take seriously the risks associated with that and be really careful and aware about that. But also, we've had these folks on the show before, but there's a group, Alta Heritage Foundation, is pairing archaeologists with canine forensic teams to help recover cremains, like ashes,
yes.
of people's loved ones in urns and stuff from fire sites. And so that's a free service. They're getting people together for that. And if somebody's interested in having something like that done and working with an archaeologist, it's important not to go in and be sifting and messing around because you're jumbling up that context. So when you're looking for something, you want to make sure that you get in there and target it before everything gets all smeared around, because then the chances of finding something are much lower.
So don't go in with a shovel or a rake, I think I'm hearing.
Yeah, don't go in with a shovel or a rake if you're looking for an urn with ashes, because that could displace that more. But also, if you have something specific you want to find in a part of the house, make sure you do that deliberately so you don't smear everything together, because then you just have a needle in a haystack situation. Whereas if it's intact the way it fell, you're more likely to be able to kind of pinpoint the zone where things might be.
I've noticed that from some of the accounts of people going back into their where their homes were, just saying, okay, this is the bedroom or where the bedroom
yeah.
was. So in that corner was where this thing was. And it makes it at least somewhat easier if there's any evidence left to be able to find the item in question.
Sure. And, of course, I'm happy to consult with anybody. If they have any questions, they can get a hold of me and I can help them come up with a strategy. But basically, I think the biggest concern is just the toxicity, potential toxic exposure of some of these sites. So it's important to follow recommendations by the guidance that people are putting out on how to deal with that, depending on what kind of building was burned.
Yeah, when the FEMA guy was here last week and we were talking about things like asbestos still being put into some homes as late as 2004, not a great thing. You know, I think about the plastic clock radio next to the bed melted in a pile. What was in that? You know, all the other things that you have in your house, all your household cleaners and stuff now no longer in containers and vaporized on the spot. So all kinds of things to consider there. George Kramer, have you been involved in reconstructions after a loss in a fire before?
I worked on a hotel project in Portland that was condemned because of a fire, and we, you know, reconstructed it, and actually it ended up being an award-winning project. It's a messy business.
Mm-hmm.
The problem with a lot of the buildings in Talent and Phoenix that were lost, the historic structures, is that they were wood structures.
Mm-hmm.
Usually, you know, a brick building where the interior floor and ceiling systems are burnt, rebuilding that is a whole lot different than rebuilding a building where the structural system itself has been damaged by fire. It's possible.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted to just sort of plop in here, though, that one of the things I think cities need to be concerned about as they look towards rebuilding is that these historic structures almost by definition don't meet modern standard.
Mm-hmm.
They don't meet building code, they don't meet zoning code. They were special because they were old and different. And so sometimes the interaction between a need to rebuild or a desire to rebuild and trying to comply with laws that don't accommodate that
mm-hmm.
is really, really complicated. And that's going to be a challenge, trying to make the best Talent and Phoenix downtowns and these other communities that we can.
And that's a good point, that, you know, the reason the place looks quaint is because it's built in a way that we don't build anymore, and there are reasons we don't
mm-hmm.
build like that anymore. Huh, interesting
exactly.
point. Yeah, and I know you mentioned working on a hotel in Portland, but I was reminded the other day that the Hotel Medford, or the Medford Hotel that stands today, is not the original.
Yes. No, it's not.
Mm-hmm.
Not. And you know, Talent, there's an excellent example in Talent of a reconstructed building. It wasn't burnt, but the depot.
Yeah, the train station.
We rebuilt that from the ground up.
Mm-hmm.
None of it is historic, but everyone thinks it is, and mm-hmm. so it can be done.
And does it meet code as it is now?
The new one actually does.
Mm-hmm.
Or it meets code as of 2004, or whenever we built it.
Mm-hmm. All right. Yeah, I was going to ask about that because I keep seeing the references to the Historic Talent Train Depot and just giggling because it's only 16 years old. It's a recreation of the old Southern Pacific Depot. Yeah. So that's an example of a way that...
It's the highest compliment you can get as a restoration consultant.
Good point there. Excuse me. Curry Gill, how, in addition to giving suggestions to how people in historic preservation reach out to their communities, how would you like to see communities reach out to people involved in historic preservation?
Well, I think of them as a resource, certainly, if they still exist. And frankly, if, you know, you grew up in that community and you lost your yearbook or think, you know, you might find some of the things that you're looking for or would like to research in their spaces.
Mm-hmm.
If they were damaged, I will also throw out that smoke was an issue around the whole state, mm-hmm. and that does affect historical collections. So they may be limiting access for a while until they assess the smoke damage to their materials and what that, because if they touch it, depending, like Chelsea mentioned, there's a million different kinds of smoke. And so depending on what happened for them, they might have different needs and they might have to do different processes for them. So give them time, I would say, but then also view them as a resource and keep an eye out if they're looking for volunteers to help with these things.
Mm-hmm. I'm impressed by the part of this list of how to approach the 2020 wildfire recovery to the whole heading about be a shoulder for healing. Be there.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. I think I've seen that so far, and I hope that it continues for the next years that it takes for all of us to recover.
Okay. It's an interesting moment in history to consider history and our exploration of it. This is this month's edition of Underground History. Chelsea Rose from Southern Oregon University Laboratory of Anthropology, our constant companion and setup person. Thank you for producing the segment, Chelsea.
Yeah, stay safe, everybody.
All right. Take care. George Kramer, local historical preservationist working around Oregon. Thank you for joining us.
My pleasure, Jeff.
And Curry Gill from Oregon Heritage. Thank you so much for spending time with us today.
I appreciate it. Take care.
All right, you too.